Session number 27075, Reel 23.
Squadron Leader Leggett, Reel 23. Could I ask you a little about the kind of sorties you were flying there? What would the duration of a sortie be normally?
Normally, with normal tankage and an ordinary patrol flying at low revs and so on, you could stretch it to about 2 hours, but usually an hour 45 was about as much as one would do. With overload tanks, that gave us another couple of hours, so a Hurricane could stay up for about 4 hours odd. In fact, when we flew from Furious, we were airborne for 'Flight from the Ark Royal to Takali Airfield, Malta. Hurricane fitted with overload, long-range tanks, and we were airborne for 4 hours and 10 minutes. And we still had some fuel reserve. I dare say it could have been stretched to 4.5 hours at absolute maximum.
How do the overload tanks work?
Well, they're quite simple. They just bolted them to the underside of the wing, one under each wing, and they were connected by, believe it or not, rubber tubes and two little glass tubes connecting the rubber tubes together. And there was my memory is failing me. I can't remember. There must have been a special fuel valve in the cockpit so that we could switch over . No, I've forgotten how it works now. However, it was possible to draw fuel from the overload tanks into the main tanks. And you certainly turned something. You turned a valve, and this started the pumping, and you could pump out until they're empty. But you just had one opportunity to use the fuel in the overload tanks. When they're empty, that was it. You're then on main tanks, and you carried on until they were dry.
Would you use the long-range tanks first?
Yes, I think we did. Yes, I think that's right. I think we did use them first. And I was trying to remember the capacity. No, not very good on long-range tanks. Factors, of course. We did use them quite a bit, in point of fact. We used them in the desert, in 73 Squadron. If there was a particular operation on, or if we were at an airfield that was really too far back for us to make much use of the possibilities, strafing up possibilities. So we would have long-range tanks fitted for those operations. One I remember in particular, we were put up late one evening, six of us, with long-range tanks, and we were to go and find some enemy airfields. He's in southern Tunisia now. And we set off in the direction of these airfields. And control came up and gave us news that there were, I think, 6 bandits at such and such a height. And as luck would have it, at that precise moment, they were in front of us, diving, Ju-88s. They were diving, and they were diving on El Hamma airfield. And we immediately went at these fellows. But they saw us and pulled away and just dived for home. Well, I latched onto one, Ju-88, and he must have been, a mile ahead of me, I should think. And he just headed north. Didn't dive any further. We were about 5,000 or 6,000 feet. He just headed north, and I followed him. And it just went on and on and on and on, and I couldn't gain on him at all. If it hadn't been for the long-range tanks, I could have caught him easily. Well, I could have caught him anyway. But the long-range tanks reduced the performance to a point where I couldn't catch this 88. Anyway, I got to it as close as I possibly could. Pressed the button and emptied the guns in his general direction. I don't suppose any of them hit, but I thought there was always a chance with that just. And then, you'd never believe it, I'd emptied my ammunition. There hadn't been another aircraft in the sky at all. I'd been looking all around. There was nothing else anywhere. And emptied my ammunition, turned round and started heading back southwards. And blow me if another Ju-88 didn't go whizzing past in the opposite direction. So he got away with it too, to my considerable annoyance.
Was there any way of jettisoning the
No, you couldn't. No, on the Hurricane, for reasons best known to themselves, they made them non-jettisonable. I must say, it does seem fairly obvious that it should be possible, and most long-range tanks can be jettisoned. I'm not sure about Spitfire, but certainly Kitty Hawks, all American aircraft, Kitties and that, I'm sure Mustangs as well, could jettison their long-range tanks. P-40s, they all did, but not Hurricanes, which is always a bit silly. Maybe we hadn't got many long-range tanks.
When you were doing the initial patrolling over El Alamein, you mentioned, obviously, you were given direction from the controller. How did that work in the desert? Because, obviously, in the UK, when you've described it from getting it from your controller, where was the controller based?
He would be somewhere. We're talking about the desert now. Alongside the group commander, who would be an air vice marshal, and he would have his little empire. Now, what it comprised, I must confess, I don't know. And undoubtedly, there would be a mobile radar. This would be a radar mounted on a vehicle that could move up with everybody else. I doubt if they had anything more than a tent. There'd be a tent in which the ops control would be located. It seemed rather a pity, in retrospect, that the pilots weren't taken out to the setup I certainly didn't go. I don't know that anybody else ever went to go to group the squadron commander, of course, maybe flight commanders. Squadron commander were flitting to and fro quite regularly. But I never heard of any of the pilots going, and I think it's rather a pity. We should have been, I think, let in on what was going on, rather than just to have a voice on the end of a radio. But that's the way it was.
Had there been any innovations, obviously, from the time when you were doing night fighter operations in the UK to the time you were doing it in the desert? Had there been anything that had been introduced that was different?
No. Certainly not as far as hurricanes were concerned. Now, when the First Army came in, when the North African landings took place, the First Army came in from the west, and the air forces that came with them, they had got bow fighters. And I think it's probably true to say that most of the interception work that was being carried on was done by the radar-equipped bow fighters. But because of the way things materialized in the Western Desert, i.e. that very few nighttime sorties were carried out by the Luftwaffe, and certainly I dare say even less than from the Italians, but the activity, night activity from the Germans was so minimal that our role as night interceptors was considerably undermined. There was nothing for us to intercept, or very, very occasionally. And so our job then became one of night interdiction. And here we did fly quite regularly with long-range tanks on. And the idea was to go well behind the German lines. Now, if we knew exactly where the airfields were, these obviously would be strafing targets, if we could find them. But even in bright moonlight, and they talk about the desert moon and the fact you can read newspapers in the light of the desert moon, it was very difficult to make out any particular detail. And whatever there was, certainly from the on the German side, would be heavily camouflaged. And it wasn't at all easy to pick out specific targets on the ground. So the best one could hope for was to go well behind the lines, in the hope that they'd reckon they were pretty safe there, and they'd drive around with lights on. And this did happen from time to time, that we would find a convoy or a few scattered trucks with lights on moving about in the desert. And obviously, since they were the wrong side of the bomb line, that they were legitimate targets. We did have to be a bit careful, though, that the long-range desert group didn't become our targets. But I think it's most unlikely that they would drive around with lights on. We warned them the LRDG might be in that area. But I think it's unlikely that they'd ever have lights on. Certainly, I never heard of any incident involving LRDG. They were too busy attacking airfields and blowing up more aeroplanes than all of the rest of the Air Force put together.
How would you operate? Would you operate singly or in a group?
No, singly. We'd always go singly at night. Unless it was a late evening scramble, we might get a scramble late evening when the day boys had put the aeroplanes to bed, and suddenly something appeared on the plot, and we might be sent off as a pair, possibly, on a scramble to find out what it was. I think there was an occasion, I didn't get involved, but there was an occasion when we were sent off late evening and ran into a Stuka party of JU-87s. I don't know what their target was. They were going for something. There was quite a gaggle of them, and the squadron got stuck into them and did quite a nasty. But on the whole, our activities were to just try and find something to shoot at. Once or twice, chaps came back and reported an explosion after Strat. I got one occasion. I don't know what it was. It was southern Tunisia. Can't think of the name of the line. There was a battle
line. The Marath line.
The Marath line. Yeah, that's right. And there was a target somewhere behind the Marath line. And I couldn't really make out what it was, but it looked like a dump, I thought. It was fairly symmetrical. Anyway, I dived on it and fired with the cannon. And there was the most tremendous flash, but it was a white flash. And it practically blinded me. It did for a few moments, and I just pulled up. And it was probably a minute or two before I could see again. What had happened, I don't really know. I circled around. I could see again. I circled around a bit, but there was no signs of any fire going on down there. So what it was, I don't know. But that was the sort of thing that happened. It was targets of opportunity. Whatever you thought was a worthwhile target, have a shot at it. And really, that became the job of 73 Squadron. Right the way through from Alamein, the whole length of the desert, into southern Tunisia, and eventually finishing up in northern Tunisia at a previously owned German airfield. Quite a few interesting wrecked aircraft dotted around it. There we sat while the army cleared up the mess, and we sat and waited for the landings in Sicily.
When you're attacking these targets at night, what are the particular things that you have to be aware of attacking a ground target at night? Because I assume it's much more different than obviously attacking in daylight. Are there any particular problems of doing that at night?
You mean identifying a target?
Not so much identifying it. What, you know, how would you go about it? Is there anything that you have to be aware of flying at such low level or diving on a target?
Well, yes. obviously, one's got to have a pretty clear idea of what the terrain is that you're diving into. When I say dive, it wasn't very wise to make a steep dive, because even again the bright moon, you could be mistaken. So one would tend to come in at a shallower sort of angle rather than a steep dive, so that if something did suddenly loom up in front of you, you could pull up and get over it. But what one was conscious of the whole time, of course, was light hack. And if you were if you were in a target area, which was a known target, not merely an opportunity target, anything like an airfield or a dump of any kind that was known to be there, one was vulnerable to light attack fire from the ground. It was, generally speaking, far more alarming by night than it was by day, because everything would all be lit up. The Italians used their Breda guns, and they used a mixture of green and red ammunition. And they used to spray the sky with this stuff. They used to hose pipe the sky. And you get all these green and red lights floating upwards. And as everybody says, when they start floating up towards you, they appear to be hardly moving. And then all of a sudden they go whizzing past a few feet from your head, or it always appears that close. Generally speaking, one or two chaps did pick up a bit of damage from light ACAC. One or two were killed, in fact. Our casualty rate was pretty low. We lost, I think in the time from Alamein to Tunisia, we lost 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 or 5. We lost 4 or 5 during that quite lengthy period.
Was that all to enemy action, or was that accidents as well?
Some were known to be due to enemy action. One in particular, a chap called Chumley, he was seen by another hurricane who was there at the same time. He was seen surrounded by all this light stuff coming at, and it was no surprise that to the chap who saw it, it was no surprise that he didn't come back.
Tell you a little bit about the operation from the airfields. You mentioned a little bit about your accommodation and your own post. What about when you're operating? What about the messing facilities on an airfield?
Well, it was all tents. Even during the winter months, it was tented accommodation. So it was all rather primitive. We'd have a largish mess tent for the air crew. It was common practice in the desert for officer and NCO pilots to share the same tent. Yes, I can never understand why we had NCO pilots, but it seemed a crazy idea doing the same job. So we had this tent, and the troops. I don't know about CIA. I think all the troops shared the same tent, NCOs as well. And then everybody, and in the inside those tents, there'd be simply trestle tables, chairs of some kind, some people would do a bit of scrounging around, particularly if there's a bit of scrounging to be had in the neighbourhood, and pick up some odd bits of furniture, try and make life a bit comfortable. I think we had a rather battered old, couple of battered old armchairs. Not very much at all. I think we just sat around reading or playing cards at night. But I think usually by the time it was dark, you couldn't have bright lights on, of course, had to be damn careful with blackout. So there wasn't a great deal. I think we used to look forward as much as anything to going swimming in the afternoon. If we could get the aircraft tested and all ready for the night's work, and go and have a swim before we need get in the readiness tent. And the troop's much the same. We did once have an INSA party came to see us. Oh, that was a cause for excitement. Yes.
Did it include women performers?
Oh, yes. Oh, not half, yes. Oh, we wouldn't have had them without them. No. I don't think we had any notables. There were one or two. Vera Lynn used to go around the desert, and one or two other people of the same ilk would go around with ENSA parties. Yes, we certainly had one party. It's later on down in Ceylon, as it used to be, we had a big ENSA party down there one night. And, oh gosh, what was the little man's name? There's a green-eyed, yellow-eyed little to the south of Kathmandu. What's the name of the chap who does that? Rob Wilton? No, not Rob Wilton. Oh, it doesn't matter. Anyway, it was quite a big INSA party. Kenway and Nan Kenway, Douglas Young. And a couple of chaps, I can't remember. But no, the desert, we didn't get a lot. I don't know what we did used to do with ourselves. I think the fact is, you see, being a night squadron, we were engaged. What the day boys did, I don't know. I suppose sat around boozing. Playing cards.
What kind of rations did you have while you were out in the desert?
Oh, pretty mixed. I could never understand why the quality of what we received was on the whole fairly low. It was bully beef and biscuits most of the time. Sometimes there'd be a McConaughey stew. Sometimes there'd be a kidgeri. But the quality was never particularly good, and I could never understand why. When they had to hump thousands and thousands of tons of stuff over hundreds of miles of desert, why they didn't obtain the best possible quality. And there must have been stacks of it in Egypt and South Africa, India. Any amount of good quality food, which wouldn't require any more transportation than the rather low quality stuff. It always struck me to be a false economy. Indeed it was, I'm sure.
You mentioned the water ration. Did you have an alcohol ration while you were up there?
It wasn't rare. Was it rare? Yes. It would depend. The most reliable source of alcohol, believe it or not, was a Junkers JU-52, which we acquired. When I say we, I don't mean our squadron, but certainly units in our area. And this JU-52 used to lumber off to the canal zone and load up with all sorts of goodies and come lumbering back with it. And so for a little while we'd have plenty of bottles of beer and goodies of that kind. I think we drank bulk beer more than anything. Until we got to, when we got into, that's right, Benghazi. We had access to Italian supplies of wine, and we did drink a lot of wine. And in fact we did at Tripoli, Castel Bonito, we did acquire an enormous great vat of Chianti. I don't know what it how many gallons it was. It was a vast quantity, and it required a 15-ton truck to carry it, and that got priority loading. The tents went on afterwards, and it was rather splendid because this thing was loaded on the back of this truck, and the tap was conveniently placed so that it could be approached from the rear, and one took one's mug or whatever and helped oneself to a mugful of wine. Good Chianti, and it was good Chianti too. And that lasted us, I think it lasted us right through to Tunis. So that was rather good.